The following message is by Pastor Steve Clark of the Evangelical Free Church of Salt Lake City. More information is available at our website, www.slcevfree.org.
Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you have created the church and that you've created this moment for us to be here as part of this church and that you have decided to put your word in front of us, this passage this morning, and to teach us. Thank you. And so in saying thank you, we also want to say, please, will you please open it up to us and help us to understand it? And as we deal with a lot of things here that are quite difficult to understand, that are even quite debated, will you also give us an attitude that shows above the different views we have, we maintain a spirit of unity and love. That is what will show that we are of you, that we love one another. And so I pray, make that apparent, even while you teach. We make clear what's here. Help us to understand and keep us close to one another in love. So build your church this morning, Lord. That's what I'm praying. Build your church. Help us to handle this well. Build us up and change, perhaps change how we see things, if that's right. I know some of us will disagree here, Lord. Perhaps change how we see things, if that's right. And if not, then don't. We surrender to you. You are Lord. You are teacher. Guide us this morning. Thank you, Lord. Amen. Last week, we were in Matthew chapter 23. And there we saw Jesus' confrontation with the Jewish religious leaders come finally to its dramatic conclusion. In righteous anger, Jesus pronounced the judgment that was coming on those leaders and that entire religious system. It was about to be torn down, destroyed. The city, the temple especially, that stood at the heart of all that whole system there of law and sacrifice and rule and order, condemnation and destruction was about to fall on it all, on them, and upon the entire generation, Jesus said. And as he said that, a tone of sorrow crept in because God the Son takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. None at all. He's heartbroken by it. But that's what's coming. Destruction. And as he stopped speaking, and then chapter 24, verse 1, Jesus left the temple and was going out of the city away. And his disciples walking with him were confused. This feels like the Lord abandoning his temple. He said it was going to be left desolate. He's walking away. He's leaving. But look at it. It's marvelous. It's amazing. And it's so very, very important because this is God's throne on earth. This is the place where he said he had chosen to dwell. His presence is here. And from here, his influence, his control over his people here in this land, and we think eventually over all of the earth, it starts here and it extends out from here. Jesus, this is everything. And it is awesome. It's the hope of the nations right here. Gone? Abandoned and gone? For sure. Like I said, it is all going to be totally destroyed. Really? They're processing this as they walk out of the city and down the slope and up again onto the Mount of Olives, opposite the temple grounds, just across the short little valley there. It's kind of all laid out in front of them. And now, like they've done often before in the Gospel of Matthew, now that they are away with him in private, they're going to ask him to explain the provocative thing that he just said. This has happened a lot. He says something in public that they kind of are puzzled by, and in private now, what does that mean? Explain this, please. And as Jesus answers, we get another long section of teaching from him regarding his and their, and then eventually also our future. Matthew chapters 24 and 25. These next few chapters have often generated a lot of interest. I can't tell you how many people here in the congregation said, I can't wait to get to that chapter. It's understandable. I mean, you can see why. It generates a lot of interest and a ton of writing and debate and confusion. Because it's not hard to see. There's a lot of stuff here that's kind of complicated. There's a lot of detail here that's tricky and it's intricate in some ways, and so I'm not going to minimize that. Right off, let me just say that I acknowledge that some parts of what I say, and it really doesn't matter what I say, some parts of what I say are going to upset some of us. I could go any particular way, and some portion of the congregation is going to say, like, what, really? I know that. That's going to happen. So please, I'm just going to ask, I'm going to try to do my best to be gracious and open-handed with it, but please do your best to listen carefully and fairly to what I'm going to say, to what I'll say about this. And then if at the end you still aren't persuaded and we still disagree, that's okay. Because what we need to acknowledge here is that nothing that's here actually affects the gospel of God's grace by which a person becomes a Christian, period. And by which then a person is forgiven before God, and by which then the future is secure for you. If you're a Christian, the future is secure, however the details exactly work out. And that's only because of the gospel of God's grace, Christ's death on the cross. And that's not endangered in this passage with one interpretation or the other. So resting there, we can all be, take a, okay. So listen carefully to this, and if at the end we disagree, that's okay. But there are things that are here about the future and that are tricky that we're going to be looking at. And I want to be clear also that I am aware of lots of different positions, and over the course of my years being a Christian, I've moved through and understood several of them, and where I am right now, and have been for a little while, is I am far and away persuaded by the analysis of theologian R.T. France. If you know who that is, then you know who that is. He is by no means the only person who's elaborated on this view. It's just the way his writings are how I've encountered it most recently, and it would be easiest for you to encounter it if you want to evaluate it more. His commentary on Matthew, copyright 2007, would be a great and easy place to go. R.T. France, Matthew, copyright 2007. His view, I'll call it his view, but it's not just his view, but that's the view that, in my opinion, handles the text best in its historical context. More on that in a minute. It carefully and rightly honors the time markers in the text, doesn't do too much with them, doesn't overlook them. Deals with the time markers well. It answers in order the two separate questions that the disciples asked that we'll see here today. And then, after all that, it enables us to make normal, straightforward sense of Jesus' statement that what we're going to talk about today is going to happen in the lifetime of the people who heard him say it. In the lifetime of the living generation. That this analysis makes great sense of the text. But that being said, I realize also that some people hearing what I'm going to say will be, and this is, I'm trying to be clear about where I'm coming from, but also I hope to be humble and gracious about this. I think some people hearing what I say will be confused by a common and easily overlooked problem. A common and easily overlooked problem. Many, many Christians, I think, humbly, graciously, let me say this, I think many, many Christians misread this material in these chapters because they don't read the chapters closely in their original historical context, but instead read them in the context of the now established Christian theological views. This is important. Larger Christian tradition has influenced our understanding, and then we read the passage and miss Jesus' actual statements from what we think we know about his return. This happens all throughout this section. An easy example and a very important one in today's passage. When Jesus talks about the Son of Man coming on the clouds, we'll see that today. He is not quoting Revelation chapter 1, which is for sure talking about Jesus' return to the earth from heaven on clouds. He's not quoting Revelation 1, though. When John wrote Revelation, it includes language even from our passage today. John is applying Jesus' teaching to his situation. Jesus is not applying John's teaching to his situation. He's 60 years before John. Important point. Jesus, when he says this, is referring to Daniel chapter 7. The passage that he and his audience all had and all understood. And it's that interpretation, it's from that perspective that we have to understand Jesus. And then if we were to work on into Revelation and John, we could work that out. That's obviously beyond our scope this morning. We must keep this in mind. It is a commonly and repeatedly forgotten point made by readers and even translators who translate certain words because they have to mean certain things. And actually even commentators on these chapters. It is very interesting to know how many times you can read, that's not the common understanding of, therefore, I believe it. No, that's not the common Christian theological understanding, but what did the context mean? This happens all the time here. Very important. But once a person sees this and gets accustomed to kind of checking down on reading with traditional Christian theological eyes and instead reads with eyes of context, Gospel of Matthew context, first century context, Old Testament context, you do that and become accustomed to that, I actually don't think this material here is that hard to understand. Which is strange to say. See if you agree with me at the end. But I actually don't think it's that hard to understand when we read it in its context. We'll see. And if at the end you're not persuaded and disagree, that's okay. There's a lot here, obviously. So I'm gonna read this passage, and after I read down through verse 35, we'll turn and draw two observations. The first, which is by far the longest, is just I'm going to walk through the verses. And there's obviously much here that I won't be able to touch on all the details, and I won't be able to interact with all of the opposing views. I'll grab a few things here and there that I think are most confusing or most debated or most pivotal, but I'm mostly going to be just explaining it as it is. And then in the second observation, which will be a lot shorter, I'm going to try to like get above the weeds and try to find something that speaks to us, that matters for us here now. I think there's something here. So, with that long introduction, here we go. Matthew 24, verses 1 to 35. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death. You will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. Let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. But for them there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. For the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he's in the rooms, in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you will know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Matthew 24, 1 to 35. So the first longer walking through the passage, here's the observation I'm going to put in a sentence. Dramatic regime change will happen when the wicked besiege and destroy the place that God had chosen to dwell. Dramatic regime change will happen when the wicked besiege and destroy the place God had chosen to dwell. I put emphasis on when, because that's the interrogative in the first question the disciples asked Jesus. Tell us, when will these things be? The things that you, Jesus, were just talking about. In the parables that we saw, heard, and then in the direct speech of the woe pronouncement that we just saw and heard, and then lastly when you were talking about the stones being torn down, all of those things, the destruction of the old system, this city built around the temple and the priests and the teachers of the law and the Pharisees who teach works righteousness and the critical centrality of sacrifice here on this altar and in this building, this earthly throne of God in the temple, that all, he said, was over. The end. Done and coming down. And their question is, when? That's the first question. So what we're reading and talking about, this is the first thing we need to be alerted to, what we're reading and talking about today is the timing of the end of Jerusalem, the end of the temple, and the end of the whole religious system in operation at the time. This question and answer is not about the end of the earth or the end of all time. The second question, set off by the second interrogative, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age? It's also a question about when, asked in a different way, different interrogative. That one is about the end of the earth and the end of all time, and we'll get to that next week, because the answer is that second. But it's important to note one thing about how they ask that question and what they say. what we're going to talk about next time. It's important to note one thing about that for understanding this morning. When they ask, what will be the sign of your coming? The word they use there for coming, the word that's put there, is an interesting word. I'll call it a special word, but it's not really special. It was used in common speech. It's perfectly fine to translate it as coming. It was used to talk about the coming of dignitaries and kings. But it might be a word we'd be helped to put as appearing, because it's different than the ordinary word for transiting from one spot to another. Somebody's over here and they come here. That's a different word. They use this, I'll call it special word. We might say appearing. It's this appearing that they asked about second, and what Jesus discusses second next week. But for today, when will be the end of all of this? And his answer at first, verses 4 to 8, is not now will you see everything going poorly. Wars and rumors of wars and natural disasters, that's just life here. Stuff that happens. Just the beginning of the birth pangs. You can't tell if it's Braxton Hicks contractions, if it's the beginning of a 25-hour labor, if it's the beginning of a 3-hour labor. It's something. But what? You can't tell. The sign of the contractions is not yet the birth. It's not the end. But that's going to happen. And also, that time will squeeze you too. Verses 9 to 14, then, that is, in the time of those beginning birth pangs, things for you, my disciples, will also be hard, not easy. That's also a part of this beginning time, because this normal experience, this persecution that Jesus has been talking about, all it's actually going to happen. Jewish leadership and Gentiles too will not take kindly to the disciples proclaiming Jesus and his gospel of his kingdom over the whole known occupied world. That's what the term in verse 14 means. In our English, it reads just world, and probably, commonly, Christians, we read all nations and world, we think of the entire globe, but it's actually a different word for world. It's not the word like for globe or earth or land or cosmos. It's a word that's the inhabited place. He means the inhabited area. It is appropriate for us now, in our spot in history, to realize the inhabited area is larger than anybody at that time knew. It's appropriate for us to think about missions going to every corner of the globe. It's appropriate for us to apply even the Great Commission at the end of this to every place. That's perfectly fair and appropriate for us now to apply it that way. But in the context where it's spoken, what did Jesus mean and what do his listeners hear? They heard to the inhabitable world, all the nations, which means the larger Mediterranean world. Want an example of this? Pentecost, where these same people are present. And it says there at Pentecost, devout men were gathered from every nation under heaven. But there weren't any Japanese there. And no representatives of Northern Canadian native tribes. Every nation under heaven. It's then listed, the people there he means, it's the larger Mediterranean world. All the world and all the nations. Jesus is saying the gospel is going to go forth to them. He's basically talking about the book of Acts. Book of Acts is structured with the gospel is going to go from Jerusalem to Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth, and it's finished when Paul reaches Rome, the ends of the earth. Understanding it in its context, we can see what he means and what he doesn't mean. He's talking about what's going to happen in the following decades. The gospel is going to go forth. My kingdom is going to be announced, and people are going to have all kinds of different reactions to that. The authorities are going to hate it. They're going to persecute you. Some will listen. There will be false converts, and some will fall away. There will be false prophets who will proclaim another message. Saul will persecute the church. There will be riots in Ephesus, but churches will be planted, and then Peter and Paul will be killed by Rome. All of that is going to happen. Book of Acts, next several decades. Then the end will come. End of verse 14. When? Here's when, verse 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation, grammatically, it's clear that is a thing, not a person. Grammatically, it's a thing, not a person. An idolatrously polluting thing. Positioned, it is standing, it stands, positioned in the holy place. What is that? Well, obviously lots of people have lots of different ideas about it. A lot of discussion. Helpfully, Luke's account tells us clearly what he means. Luke's account tells us clearly. Let the reader of Daniel understand Luke. There's a lot of debate, but Luke says, because he drops the allusion to Daniel, Luke chapter 21, verse 20, writing the very same speech here, in the very same place, very same context, says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. The idolatrously polluting thing is the Roman army, set, placed on God's holy mountain here at Zion to bring desolation. That's the abomination. All of the pagan Romans with their worship of the emperor and their worship of their idolatrous standards, their flags basically, they're there on God's holy mountain, desolating the place soon. And when you see that, run. That's what he says. Because, verse 21, this is about to be the worst thing ever. Worst ever until now, worse than anything ever will be again. That's what Jesus says. And surely this is hyperbole. Jesus has spoken in hyperbole a lot through this book. Josephus, the Jewish historian who was present when Jerusalem fell, used the very same language to describe it. The worst thing that's ever happened in the past, the worst than anything that'll ever happen in the future. That's what he said about the fall of Jerusalem. It's hyperbolic language. It's a way that people talk. A catastrophe is going to happen. The worst thing ever. The worst atrocity ever. That would destroy everybody. Nobody would live through it unless God were to cut it short. And for the sake of his people, he will. The siege went on for quite some time, years in fact. And history tells us that a bunch of Christians actually did escape from the siege, and a bunch lived through it. Many survived. And history also shows us the truth of verses 23 to 26. In the city and around it, all during the time of that siege, as was always the case in the Old Testament when enemies showed up, false prophets came and said, hang on, God's going to deliver us. False messiahs came and said, I'm the one that God has sent to do the delivering. Or prophets spoke about messiahs. Messiah is here. He is coming. He's gathered an army. Hang on. God's going to come and deliver. And Jesus says, don't believe that. It's not true. Don't go out to Messiah over here. Don't believe that in here. It's not true. None of it is. For, verse 27, for when lightning flashes, when it really does flash, everyone can see it and there's no question. There's no doubt. So, likewise, will be the coming. Oh, and there's our special word. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. When I appear, there will be no doubt. Like lightning flashing in the sky, you don't have to argue that it happened. Everybody saw it. Like vultures circling over top of a corpse, you don't have to see the corpse. You can see the vultures. Everybody knows what they're circling. They don't circle anything else but meat. That's how it will be when I appear. There will be no doubt when I return. No need to argue it. So if they're arguing for it, don't believe them. Don't follow that. Because this is not my return. Rather, this is the end, like I spoke of. Verse 29, immediately after. Mark uses the word immediately all the time, basically meaning like, and next there was, or something else happened. Matthew doesn't use the word like that. It has meaning when Matthew uses it. What he means is, next, right up next, this happens. Here comes the end. And also at verse 29, here comes the part that is, I think, most easily understood, and I would say misunderstood, to be about the second coming of Christ and the final judgment. In particular, because verse 29's apparent supernatural creation-altering events. I mean, we read that. It's all these, the moon and the sun and the stars, all that stuff, that creation-altering, sun darkened, that's supernatural creation-altering. But what did Jesus have in mind when he said it? What did the disciples hear when they heard him? Jesus is nearly quoting the Greek version of Isaiah 13, verse 10. It's a close quote, the Greek version, describing God's destructive judgment of Babylon. And a part of it also is pretty close to Isaiah 34, verse 4, describing God's destructive judgment of all nations, especially Edom. And in some ways, it also resembles, pretty closely resembles, language from Ezekiel 32, verses 7 and 8, describing God's destructive judgment of Egypt. In Amos chapter 8, verse 9, describing God's destructive judgment of Israel, where all who dwell in the land will mourn. In Joel 2, verse 10, 2, verse 30 and 31, and chapter 3, verse 15, describing his judgment of Zion. In other words, Jesus is using very common Old Testament language of judgment. And obviously, because of the sheer repetition of it, it is not a literal one-time occurrence. I know I'm pushing upstream here. But I think the repetition of that about all those different nations should tell us that's not a literal one-time occurrence. It's the Old Testament language of judgment. Jesus is talking like his Bible talks when God executes great judgment and makes empires to fall, overturns wicked regimes. That's how he's talking, how the Bible's talking, and it's actually how we talk too when we say things like the sky has fallen and the world is turned upside down by an earth-shattering event. None of that's literal, but it's powerfully metaphorical. This is the language of total regime change, of wicked regime change, ironically spoken about Jerusalem, the temple, and the covenant people. First century Jews had no way of imagining a world like this. It's the worst catastrophe ever. The throne of God destroyed, the house of God torn down, his presence gone, made desolate by abominable, idolatrous, wicked enemies. The covenant seemingly broken. God's promise broken. At least the old covenant. The sky has fallen and the world is turned upside down. When? When Rome finally besieges and destroys this all, the old covenant is over. Babylon did that once, but the old covenant wasn't over. Now it's over. When? When Rome comes. Regime change. Out with the old. And now what? Verses 30 and 31. Which I'm going to come back to in my second observation. I think that's the part that speaks to us today. But for now, glance ahead at the conclusion of verses 32 to 35. Like you can tell when summer's coming from looking at a tree's blossom, so you can look at all these things I just mentioned and can tell that the end of the old regime is near, right at the doors. Grammatically, your translation, not all, but your translation probably says he is at the gates. Here's another one of these places where grammatically it could be he, but it shouldn't be. It should be it. It is near. The thing I've been talking about all this time, it is near. The established idiom of right at the door. It's the word for door, actually, not gates. Right at the door. An established idiom that means very near. Even today, we say that. It is very near. So near, in fact, verse 34, it's going to happen in this generation. The people who are alive right now hearing me say this will see all these things happen. Take it to the bank. It's more certain than heaven and earth's eternality. They'll fall before my words do. Bank on it. And that's what happened in AD 70. The Romans came, besieged the place for some long period of time, and then razed the city. And the old system and all that it was ended. This is what they asked, and Jesus answers the question. And while, of course, it's interesting to know, and I think for some of us this enters into the realm of mind candy. Don't let it go there and become what your whole Christian life is about, trying to sort out this stuff. And if, as you listen to me lay it all out there, you say, like, I don't buy it for that reason, I don't buy it for that reason, okay. I mean, I'm happy to talk about this a little bit. A little bit. And I, the reason I want to do that is that I want to be respectful. I want to say, like, I've said it like this, and I graciously, humbly, I want to say, I'm not questioning if this is the right way to understand this. I'm convinced this is the right way to understand this. But I also want to acknowledge that a lot of people that I highly, highly, highly respect see it differently. So maybe I'm wrong. I don't think so. But maybe I'm wrong. And so I want to have that kind of a respectful conversation where I can say, this is where I'm coming from. But I'm not going to, I don't think we should spend forever making this the mind candy that consumes our lives. It's peripheral. The issue here is peripheral. So we can talk about it a little bit. It's interesting to know. It's helpful. But it's also worth asking, what are we to do with it? What's it here for? What are we to take from this? And I think that's actually a really important and helpful question. That's where I want to go in the second observation. This is shorter. Take a few minutes to talk about this. But here's the second point. The new regime has come and is very effectively accomplishing its godly purposes. The new regime has come and is very effectively accomplishing its godly purposes. It works. Once we move through all this brief explanation here, with, you know, agree or not, or intrigued or not, we do have to come to the end and say, like, so what do we do with this? What's the point? Why is this all recorded for us now? And I will say, maybe, because some of this will be repeated when he appears again from heaven. Acts 1 says that as they're watching him ascend into heaven on a cloud, the angels there say, as you saw him go, so he will return in the same way. So maybe there are some similarities between what has already happened and what will happen. There are little things that are mentioned here and there throughout the New Testament. For my money, I'm, as I said, I'm sure Jesus is not talking about that here, but I would not say that I am sure what all the details at the end are going to look like. Maybe. Some of this resembles some of what will come. But I don't think that's why it's here. Because as we have seen often, as Jesus said in this passage, as he's going to say repeatedly in the passage coming up, when he appears, it'll be sudden and unexpected, and we will not have any way of interpreting any clues beforehand. Like a thief in the night, he will come. That is repeated and clear. So it wouldn't help us to know beforehand so that we can identify it. It'll happen and we'll see it. And after we see it, there won't be anybody confused by what they just saw. So it's kind of not a real helpful hint. I don't think that's why this is here, to help us understand what's going to happen. It won't help us know beforehand, and once it happens, we won't need any help. I think there's another reason. I'm looking at this, and I'm trying to think about, why is this here in the Bible? Why did Jesus answer this in such detail for all of them? And why is it written here for us? And I think it's because while all of this has happened, it's not all over. It's not all over. What would have most encouraged the disciples from this is what is meant to most encourage us from this. And it's in 29, 30, and 31. 29 had all that colorful language about the upheaval and the great reversal of authority and rule, regime changes. Out goes the old. What comes in? Well, the new. The outgoing of the old would have been incredibly troubling to them. Most of us here are Americans, and if you think somebody who said, somebody who you thought was an American politician campaigning for government office said, the White House, the Capitol, the Supreme Court, the Treasury Building, the Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson Memorials, all are going to be wiped out. Gone. You would have thought, that's a catastrophe. And what are you even doing then? What are you campaigning for? I mean, if I thought you were trying to like fill the White House, and you say the White House is going to be wiped out. What is going on? It would have been very unsettling language for them. They think Jesus is coming to fix what is wrong in those places, not raise it to the ground. And he just said, it's all going. And then very shortly, he's going to be crucified, in part for saying things like that. And then very shortly after that, there's going to be, yes, this period he described where the gospel is going to go forth, but it's a back and forth tug of war. There are churches planted, for sure, yeah, and there are apostles who are executed, and there are false converts and false prophets, and all the while, Jerusalem with its leaders and its temple stands. Is this Jesus movement going to be a flash in the pan? What's going to happen? You say catastrophe is going to happen. You know, this is costing us a lot. Really? And then he's going to say, actually, here's how you know. That all is going out, and something new is coming in. What replaces it? The Son of Man, vindicated and enthroned in heaven as the King of God's new kingdom. Vindicated and enthroned in heaven as the King of God's new kingdom. And when you see all these predictions come true, and that one in particular, then you will know the old has gone, and I'm king, and my kingdom endures forever. That's the end of verse 30, the coming of the Son of Man. We mentioned this before. It was in chapter 10, in chapter 16, and it's going to show up again at his trial in chapter 26. So four times in this gospel. When it comes up at the trial, all of them are allusions to and direct quotes of Daniel chapter 7, where the Son of Man comes on the clouds, not to earth. Key point. This is some of our Christian understanding informing when we should stop. He's coming on the clouds, not to earth. He's coming on the clouds to heaven. Read Daniel 7. He's coming on the clouds into the presence of the Ancient of Days. When the Son of Man comes on the clouds to heaven, not using the special word about appearing, when he just moves to heaven. Where is he? He's gone. He's moved to heaven. That's where his throne is. Not here in Jerusalem, not on where David's mount is. It's in heaven. His throne's in heaven. He's come to there to reign. He moves to there. He is vindicated, approved of, and given all authority to rule in glory and honor and might. At the trial, the high priest, who, as we'll see this, asks him, tell us straight up, are you the Christ or not? And Jesus says, from now on, you will see me coming on the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tears his robe and said, what more? There's the blasphemy, you heard it. The high priest did not think he was talking about his second coming some thousand years away. The high priest said, he's talking about Daniel 7. He's just claimed to be the omnipotent ruler of the world. Do we need to hear anything else? Everybody in Matthew, everybody in that time period knew Jesus has been using this Son of Man language all throughout this gospel, and what he means is Daniel 7 is him. He has come into the presence. See, that you read the chapter, Daniel says the Son of Man will be given the dominion of glory. This is the quote from dominion of glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. And Jesus said, from now on, you will see me there. That's me. Blasphemous. Unless it's true. And Jesus says, take it to the bank, it's true. And how will you know? Watch this. The old regime is coming down. And the new one's coming up. How do you know? Because you'll see the effects of it. You'll see the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. What's the sign? The last verse, verse 31. The kingdom witness to all of the world. The sign that I reign, that I'm not dead, that I'm not gone, that I'm not off in hiding somewhere. The sign that I reign is that I'm winning. I'm going to gather my people from all the four corners of the wind, everywhere, from one end of heaven to the other. I'm going to gather together all my people. The kingdom mission proves the kingdom is and proves the king reigns. He goes to heaven to go gather all of his people from every tongue and tribe and nation from the four corners of the earth. Unlike anything ever seen under the old system, but do you realize it was called for under the old system? That was the assignment in the old system. It's prophesied in the old system. The old system was supposed to gather in all the peoples. Abraham was supposed to gather in all the nations, but it never happened. And now it does. Look, there's the sign. I have been given all authority in heaven and on earth. I am about my work of gathering in my people. That tells us, that's the sign, as the one system is cast down and is no more, the other system is lifted up, and Jesus shows himself to be king by his reign. We can't see him with our eyes, but we can see the work that he does everywhere. Tells us about him, tells us where he is, tells us what our assignment is too, as citizens of his kingdom. We're to be about the harvest work with him. In the meantime, we can see this world full of trouble and tribulation is at the same time comfortably reigned over by the king who is accomplishing all of his godly purposes and doing his work. He can be trusted to hold all the events of time in his hand. These ones happened. The ones he's going to talk about yet to come will happen. He has come into heaven and he will come again to earth. He will appear. In the meantime, he sits in heaven reigning. That's told to us so that we'll rest in it and trust him. I realize, I don't know what you make of all that. We can talk about it a little bit if you like. I do want to push a little bit here on this part here at the end, the second point I've made here. I really don't think you can dispute that. I may be wrong about the other stuff. The Son of Man coming on the clouds to heaven is I think, very clear. Very clear. And the point we're supposed to take from that and most trust in and rest in is that that means he sits reigning now and his kingdom is coming. You're a part of that now. Rest in that. Talk about the details if we want. Rest in that. Let me pray. Lord, help us to sort out all these things that are confusing. Sort out all these things that may trouble us in one way or another. We make our eyes to focus on what we need to be focused on. We allow us to engage graciously with one another as we talk about and discuss things that are disputable. Show in all of it, over all of it, that you are real and that we are yours, and show that by our love for one another. Thank you, Lord, for how you have worked and accomplished your will, and for how you will work and finish your will. Help us to rest in that and trust you. Thank you. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message by Pastor Steve Clark of the Evangelical Free Church of Salt Lake City in Salt Lake City, Utah. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.slcevfree.org or call us directly at area code 801-943-0091. Our mailing address is Evangelical Free Church of Salt Lake City, 6515 South Lyon Lane, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84121.